And so, 2 years and a month after the finishing line of the Boston Marathon exploded into the biggest terrorist attack in America since 9/11, a federal jury delivered a verdict of death to the convicted bomber. After more than 4 months of trial, 154 witnesses, and no more than 15 hours of deliberations, the jurors chose the harshest of their two options. They imposed not life in prison, but a sentence of death. And not one sentence, but six. And today we look back at how the trial ended and ahead to the path Jahar Tsarnaev now follows. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
I've been reading and listening to news accounts all weekend, Kevin, about how shocked the country is, the entire country, that a jury at Eastern Massachusetts gave the death penalty to Jahar Tsarnaev. And I'm shocked that they're shocked.
I had a lot of conversations over the weekend with people, and a number of them who said more or less the same thing. I couldn't believe that a jury sitting in Boston would do this. And the reality is they weren't in this courthouse and didn't listen to the same stuff that we listened to and that jury listened to. And it seemed to me inevitable. This jury was, for lack of a better term, inflamed. I think you have to be inflamed to sentence somebody, another human being, to death. And the evidence was just overwhelming.
You and I have never seen, and I think it's fair to say, even 9/11 did not have this level of photographs, of video, of the victims themselves and their suffering and the horror surrounding them. We saw in 9/11, largely we saw buildings on fire. There was a terror to that. We didn't see the victims.
Right.
Here we saw individual victims in their death agony.
Yeah, and I do think there is a disconnect between the public and what took place in this courthouse over the last few months. And it gets back to the whole issue of the lack of cameras, the lack of broadcast ability when it comes to covering a federal trial. That's why, in my view, so many people are surprised. As you said, we're surprised they're surprised.
People can't see this. We're on radio, not television. But I remember the first time we were talking and you used your fingers for quotation marks.
Yeah.
And you talked about death qualified.
Right.
And I find myself, ever since, I tell everybody, death qualified, yeah. My fingers go up with the quotation marks.
Yeah.
The whole idea that anybody who said they could not morally impose the death penalty in this case automatically was disqualified.
Right.
So right there you have a jury that is unrepresentative of Eastern Massachusetts.
Completely.
Of the jury sampling. And as you had pointed out, all the public opinion polls on this were pretty striking.
Yes, they were overwhelming. I mean, the most recent Globe polls were shocking because it was only 20% of people in Massachusetts thought he should get the death penalty, and only 15% of Bostonians. And it was not rooted in mercy. It was rooted in the idea that life in prison for a 21-year-old man is worse than death. It was also rooted very much in the same idea that the Richards family, that Bill and Denise Richards say, let's put this behind us. Let's sentence him to life in prison. He will disappear. We won't even think about him anymore. But now, with the death sentence, it's obvious that this case will not go away, that there will be several appeals, that this will play out in our own consciousness for the next number of years. I mean, frankly, I'd be surprised if, given his age, he is executed.
All these things enter into the debate at the last moment, but the structural inevitability of this takes us back to January 2014, yep, when a recommendation is made. Carmen Ortiz at the time would not say what she recommended. It goes up from the U.S. attorney here in Boston to the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder. We get the decision at the end of January 2014. They're seeking the death penalty. The train has left the station at that point. And there's some other politics because the administration wants to show they're fighting this idea of military commissions. They want to show and demonstrate that they can try somebody in a civilian court and get a result that's satisfactory. So now the train is going down that path. And I often wonder, your paper, the Boston Globe, it did editorialize in the fall of 2013 against the death penalty.
Right.
But really, the big editorial came at the same time Bill and Denise Richards' letter appeared after the conviction in April on all 30 counts involving Tsarnaev. And I thought, We need to hear from those editorials to have stopped this. It would have been back then.
Absolutely.
Close
too late.
To the bombings, though.
Right.
The same thing from the Cardinal, the Catholic Church. They weigh in this spring. They weren't there then.
Yeah. I think, you know, a number of people I talked to were surprised that, you know, Judy Clark is held up as one of the best death penalty opponent lawyers in the country. And you've made this point before, David. Her real strength is getting it off the table to begin with. She stops the train before it leaves the station. But once it left, frankly, what was Judy Clark going to do? Then it really became the issue of trying it. And the death qualification, to me, almost ensures, you know, unless you have some incredible mitigating circumstance, it almost ensures that you are going to get a death sentence.
Her spectacular success with David Brooke came in 1994, the case of Susan Smith, the mother who had killed her two children so that she could be with her boyfriend. David Brooke told me about this, and I asked him about what it was like in that trial. They felt confident from the start because there was sympathy for her. They had her background of mental illness, of her father's suicide, of her suicidal attempts, the fact she'd been molested by her stepfather. Here you had a completely different situation coming into it. One of the things that happened here, it seems to me, is the prosecution very effectively appealed to the jurors as sending a message, not just to the defendant in his crime, but to foreign enemies. We heard some of the language, the attack on America.
Right.
You are part of the war on global terrorism. There was that factor, and I don't know if Judy Clark or the others ever anticipated it would be so powerful.
No. Jahar Zainayev just came off as an unsympathetic defendant. He didn't engender sympathy. We all looked at him day after day, waiting to see something. I wonder what would have happened had he been able to show just some kind of human empathy, that when he listened to these people talk about losing their loved ones or their limbs, that he had an actual visceral reaction. But that didn't happen. And the only time he showed emotion was when his old aunt, who hadn't seen him since he was 8 years old, broke down and cried so much she couldn't even testify. And so if you're a jury, you're sitting there and say, wait a minute, he can cry for his own, but he can't cry for anyone else. That, to me, was probably the most defining moment in terms of why a juror could say, I'm going to take this person's life because there's nothing there. There's no human empathy.
Boy, I'm troubled about this, though, because jurors are generally told you cannot make any conclusions based on the demeanor of the defendant, or that he does not take the stand. Here, I think we all made judgments, and I think
right.
we came, I think that the media overall came to disdain this idea of him being the puppet of his older brother with that impassive, inscrutable, indifferent look.
Yeah.
And we all saw it hostily. I'm troubled about what the jury should legitimately take from that or what they just do as human beings.
Well, there were so many contradictions in this, David. I mean, they had to swear that they had no moral objection to imposing the death penalty. And I heard Judge O'Toole several times said to them that basically they had to make a moral decision. So which is it? But, I mean, all these other instructions that you're not supposed to this, you're not to do that, I always say it always comes down to human nature. And when you're sitting there and you're trying to find a reason to spare someone's life, you're looking for some human reaction, some human empathy on their part so that you can say, well, they made this incredible, horrible decision to take human life like this, take innocent human life, but there's something there. I just don't think he provided anything like that.
Three things should be done, courts generally state, to deal with prejudicial pretrial publicity. One is you delay the trial.
Correct.
That didn't happen here. The judge ruled against it. The second thing is you move the venue. Well, we've been there. It didn't happen. They applied to change venue five times. The third way is to have a thorough voir dire, the individual questioning of the jurors. Here, as you recall, there were battles at the time as to what the lawyers could ask. The judge did most of the questioning, and the judge wasn't particularly effective, I thought.
It wasn't what you'd call a searching voir dire. It just wasn't.
So we get the jury that we get. In the end, I keep on coming back. We talked about this at the time. During voir dire, I was writing notes, and I just jumped at the questioning of a woman who was the manager of a restaurant. They asked her, as they asked all of them, how would you feel about imposing the death penalty? And she took the position, I wouldn't be doing it. They would be doing
it. They did it.
And then she went on to say, you know, people ask me, how do I feel about firing someone at the restaurant? I don't fire that person. He fires himself by cheating, by showing up late. I don't do it. Mm-hmm. Not only does she make the jury, she becomes the jury forewoman. And something about that I see as representative, because in the end, I don't have responsibility for imposing the death penalty. He took the responsibility.
The one I keep thinking about, the juror that I wonder where the defense lost, was the woman who said that when Tsarnaev committed these crimes, he was a child himself. Something changed drastically in that woman's view of that. Now, it might be just the legal instruction that in order to get the death penalty, the person has to be determined to be 18 years old or older, and clearly he was 19 or close to 20, so maybe that's all it was, but I think it's more than that. I think it was her sitting there, and she's making judgments as she listens to the evidence and as she's looking at Tsarnaev.
So we are on the path to an execution. It's a long way up. It strikes me that if the government is to have real legitimacy in going forward, it has to release all these sealed documents, mm-hmm. all these sealed decisions that the judge made. Some people said he hid behind the sealing of some of those orders. We will find out a lot more information going
right.
forward.
But I think we'll have a better idea of what is really appealable for the defense. I think the defense believes they have a number of issues, but we don't know some of them because they are subject to the seals.
I think it's very important to remember that Gary Sampson, who was convicted and sentenced to the death penalty in Massachusetts, had his conviction overturned because one of the jurors was found to have fabricated, to falsified an answer in the questionnaire. And I think we're going to go back
oh, sure.
to look at conversations or social media remarks that people on that jury may have made that will be found to possibly in violation of the judge's orders.
No, I think each juror will be forensically scrubbed by the defense, because this is the point. Because he was sentenced to death, the defense actually is really starting to do its work now, because they're going to go after this every particular angle. And like, we don't know how many angles they have because so much of this stuff was sealed by Judge O'Toole. To me, it underscores the point that anybody who thinks Jahar Tsarnaev is going to go to, you know, to the death chamber anytime soon is just kidding themselves. It isn't going to happen.
I can just imagine these appeals inflaming people. They want to be done with it.
Right.
On the other hand, I can hear that voice coming back. This is what the government did. This is what the government brought on.
Right.
And this is the process that the government brought on.
They knew the process when they started this. They knew that this was not going to go away if, in fact, they got what they wanted. Yeah. They have got what they wanted. But now we are in for years and years of this.
I mean, they did shut down the defense's attempt to reach a plea deal. I'm planning on being an old man. I wish you the best of health. I really think I'm going to be in my grave. I hope you won't be. By the time we get closer to figuring this out,
I've always believed that I'm going to die before Jahar Tsarnaev. He's not going to die anytime soon.
So on that note, that serious note and somber one, this brings us to the end of the trial and the end for now of Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. But we'll be back for the official sentencing hearing, not yet scheduled, but probably a couple of months away. So don't unsubscribe from iTunes. You'll get the new episode automatically when victims deliver their impact statements and Tsarnaev is given the opportunity to speak to the court. Before we go, a few well-deserved thank yous to the people behind the scenes. First, I want to thank the WBUR team, particularly Zoe Sobel for her research and support here at the courthouse, Delisa Tobin, managing producer of program development, for her encouragement, editing, and guidance, and WBUR program manager Iris Adler for pulling this idea together. Finish Line has been a joint production between WBUR and the Boston Globe, and we want to thank the multimedia editor, Laura Amico, and the whole digital team at the Boston Globe. Finally, to our producer and editor, Jamie Bologna, for his fabulous work, making it seem, Kevin, like you and I are talking fluently and intelligibly without an or an awe. And to you, pal, it's been a pleasure and honor to have worked with you. I can imagine we'll be seeing each other at some Tsarnaev hearings 10 or 15 years from now.
I hope so, David. I enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.